Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Well, let me go at it this way. What I ultimately ended up concluding is that this is my voice. So I actually no longer am willing to say that I have spasmodic dysphonia. That approach implies that something unwanted from away came and took a piece of my voice, but ultimately it ended up giving me much more value and ability to grow than it took away. And one day a few years ago, I just started looking at it differently, and I said, you know, this is not a broken voice, it's just my voice.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot.
With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Kevin, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I found out about your work by way of your publicist who sent me a copy of your book, The Seventh Power, all of which we will get into. But given your background, I want to start with what I feel is a very relevant question. And that is, what is one of the most important things that you learned from one or both of your parents that have influenced and shaped who you've become and what you've done with your life?
I would say one of the biggest things I've learned from my parents is that people are super important. To say it differently, that people are more important than things. And that really has permeated how I have tried to live my life and how I've tried to manage and lead our company. I'm the CEO of a lumber company up in Maine, and we've got all kinds of inventory and equipment and machinery and rolling stock. But when I travel around the company, that's not really what interests me. What interests me is the people, because it's our people that really define us. Anybody can buy the equipment we have. Our differentiator is our people. And to take that one step further, really within the company, it's to see employees as human beings. You know, they're human beings that happen to have jobs. They're not workers or employees. And I think that paradigm of viewing everyone as a human being, as simple as it sounds, is actually quite powerful.
Well, I think not only is it powerful, it's quite rare in the world that we live in today where, you know, companies in general are rewarded, particularly by Wall Street, for profit maximization, not taking care of people. Like, you know, if you talk to a board of directors or investor, they're not going to say, oh, yeah, we're taking great care of our people, but the bottom line sucks. And that's sort of how do you wrestle with that paradox? How do those two things coexist?
Yeah, I'm so glad that came up. It's a priority topic of mine. I really believe that one of the key things that companies have to do in the 21st century is go back to square one and revisit their mission, their very purpose for existing. We did this a while back, and we totally reset our mission. Our primary mission at Hancock Lumber today is to make sure that the people who work at the company are having a meaningful and valuable experience. I talk about that as being an employee-centric company. So we want work to be more than just an economic exercise for the people who do it. The people who work, as we all know, spend decades and exert great energy to work, and we want that to be a meaningful experience for them. Now, our corporate profit performance is, of course, important. It matters, but I've really come to think of that as the outcome of a higher calling. It's not the mission in and of itself. It's one of the important byproducts or outcomes of running an employee-centric company that puts the experience of the people first. And what I found is when you put the experience of the people first, they will reciprocate that love and care back on the company and take even better care of it than they would have otherwise.
Yeah. So I want to come back to this because I know you talked extensively about this in the book, but there's some other parts of this that I want to talk about when it comes to your personal story. I know for a fact that this is a family-run business. It's been around for your sixth generation, if I remember correctly, and that raised numerous questions for me.
First off, was there an expectation that this is what you would do with your life, particularly because it's a family-run business? Is the expectation that if somebody within the family has to take this over?
Yeah, I've reflected on that a lot. It's such a great question. So yes, as you say, our company is actually one of the oldest in America. We trace our roots back to 1848, so before the first cannonball was fired in the Civil War. Our company was in business up here in Maine, and it's been connected to the same family, my family, uninterrupted through that whole period. And I came to work for the company back in 1991 when I was about 25, when my dad was diagnosed with cancer. He'd been running the company, and he ended up dying a few years later. Growing up, I had never thought about coming to work for the family business. I laugh about this in hindsight. It was not any part of my plan. I was teaching and coaching. But I did feel kind of at that critical moment when my dad got sick, some pressure to join the business. And it's turned out to be a great thing for me, but there wasn't any kind of formal plan that got me here into the seat I have today. And I would say going forward, we have my wife and I have two adult daughters who are both now in their 20s. And we've really tried to adopt a corporate model now where everybody leads, all the employees in the company, and I really want our two daughters to follow their own voices, whether that means they're just supportive and committed owners who help the company that way, or they ever end up working for the company, time will tell. But I would never, ever recruit a family member into the family business. That's got to be something that is really inspiring to the individual that wants to do it.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm so glad you brought that up because I'm thinking about succession and a couple of things come up. One, you know, if you have siblings, how are the choices made? I mean, you mentioned, yeah, like the person who is chosen is inspired. Now, let's say that person is inspired, but not the ideal person to do it. You know, how does that choice get made? My roommate actually had a really interesting question about this. He said, you know, one of the things he had seen in family businesses is that the second generation does really well because they saw it being built. But the next generation almost comes in with this sense of entitlement because this is just the way it's always been. Like there's been this family wealth. How do you deal or how do you avoid a sense of entitlement when it's been passed on from generation to generation? And how do you preserve the integrity of what was originally built right from the get-go, particularly when it was so long ago?
Yeah, wow. Those are, that's one sharp roommate you have. Those are great questions. Thank you for all of that. So, you know, I think it takes a number of things. It takes a little bit of luck, first of all, along the way. There are a lot of reasons why companies don't go six generations like ours has. And I think you've always got to appreciate, you know, good fortune and the thousands of people, employees, customers, and community members that have helped along the way across the generations. But I think really at the end of the day, it all comes down to a set of core values. And if those values are present within the family and the business, it's going to help guide the company in the right direction. So, for example, one of our core values really could be summarized in the word stewardship, where the company is its own entity. It's not there solely for the pleasure or the benefit of the owners. It makes a much bigger, broader contribution to society, and it has a life of its own, and the owners, to a degree, are really there to do the best they can to serve it. And it's the belief in the long run that if you put the company before yourself, if you put the people in the company before yourself, that, you know, ultimately that will pay back to you. But the other thing I'd like to say about this is that every single generation of a company, multi-generational company, is going to have to be entrepreneurial in order for that company to survive, because the world just changes so dramatically across any generation that what made sense at the beginning of a generation in terms of how business was done is going to have been disrupted dozens of times by the end of that generation. So something I've always kind of tried to speak to is certainly the founder of anything is an entrepreneur, but anyone who keeps an institution going across generations is also an entrepreneur. You could look at American government this way, and no one would say that only George Washington was a presidential entrepreneur. You know, every generation, it takes leaders who don't take the institution for granted, who know it's always vulnerable, and who are working hard to reinvent the business so that it is relevant in the future, not just in the past.
Yeah. So one thing I wondered is, you know, if I were an employee and, you know, I was looking at myself as, oh, I'm somebody here who's in a sixth generation family business, how do you actually avoid the perception of nepotism for people who are not members of your family who work for your company?
Yeah, that's a great question, too. In our case, it's easy because I'm the only member of the family that works for the company. so it would be just me that has had to overcome those hurdles. We have 530 people who are part of our team, and I'm the only member of the family that that works here. But in many family businesses, to your point, there are multiple family members that may work at the company. And again, I think it all comes back to culture, that if the culture is every a family member as an employee must earn his or her, you know, spot and path and growth and opportunities, then it's probably gonna work out just fine. And if it's the opposite, where people really feel entitled, then you're or don't have to really prove themselves, then you're probably ultimately gonna have issues in the long run. But this is why family businesses are complex entities. It's super hard to just be successful in business. Yeah. And it's super hard to, or takes work to have a harmonious, supportive family where every individual is really free to speak and live with their own voice. And then to try to put the two together adds another whole layer of complexity. So it's not easy to make a family business work across generations.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
The reason that came up for me was, there's been so much about the Murdochs as of Rupert Murdoch getting sick and getting old. And of course, we're talking billions of dollars and how much conflict this has all caused. And you're free to not answer this, but I wonder, have you had conflict in your family over the fact that you've had this business, for generations? Have there been people like, let's let it all go and cash out? Or has there been anything along those lines that's caused conflict with your family members?
That's another great question, and the answer, of course, is yes. But I look back on it all actually fondly and lovingly. Like, if you ask anybody, separate the business for a second, and ask anybody if there's ever been conflict within their family, and the answer is going to be yes. So conflict is part of the dynamic of family. But if that conflict is rooted in, care and love and people who mean well, then really it is ultimately part of how family grows and evolves and learns to respect everyone. So we've had, our share like any other family, but when I look back on it, it's actually all made us individually and collectively stronger. Conflict's a funny word because on the surface you want to avoid it, but across an entire lifetime, a life would really be empty or hollow or unfulfilled without regular doses of it. It's kind of an experience that's typically necessary for growth and change and progress. So I think about our conflict periods in a really healthy way upon reflection, not to say that there aren't moments where it's difficult.
So for the context of our listeners who haven't read your book, let's start with talking about what happened to your voice, because otherwise they might think we're having audio problems.
So back in 2010, at the peak of the national housing and mortgage market collapse, I began to have trouble speaking. Something I never thought about, always taken for granted, and done quite a bit of, and suddenly got hard. And first I thought I maybe just had a cold, but it persisted and got worse. And it turned out I've acquired a rare neurological voice disorder called spasmodic dysphonia. There are perhaps 25,000 people in North America that have it. And it has no known cause and no known cure. But it really impacted my entire life, including how I thought about leadership, because suddenly back then I had to, my talking was a lot more limited than it is right now. And I had to suddenly figure out how to lead without being able to use my voice very often. And that ended up really changing how I thought about my role as a leader and leadership broadly. This quick story I tell as an example is when it's hard to talk, you develop strategies for doing less of it. And mine at the time was to answer a question with a question, thereby putting the conversation right back on the other person. So someone would come up to me at work because I was the CEO or the boss or one of the leaders with a question or a problem. And I would listen, and I started saying simply, well, that is a good question. What do you think we should do about it? And originally, I was doing this just to protect my wounded voice. But after months and months and dozens of exchanges like this, what I observed really intrigued me. And in summary, it was this. People already knew what to do. They didn't actually, it turned out, need, after all, a CEO-centric or top-down-centric directive or solution to the vast majority of challenges that they faced in the course of a day. They knew what to do. All they really needed was some confidence and support and a safe culture to trust their voice, to feel empowered, and to lead themselves, which is when I really started began thinking about my voice condition as actually a bit of a gift, an opportunity to lead differently in a way that dispersed power instead of collected it, and in a way that strengthened the voices of others.
Wow. So before we get into the business side of this, what I really wonder is how has having this voice disorder impacted your relationship with members of your family, like your wife and your daughters? Like, what has changed about your relationship with them as a byproduct of this?
Yeah, it's strengthened in the long run all of my relationships. I really became much better at listening, much better at focusing on others, much better at sharing a conversation, sharing the room. And so it really, to me, has been a bit empowering for everyone that I'm connected to, because I just don't use my voice to dominate any kind of setting now, whether it's a family setting or a corporate one.
Yeah. So one thing I wonder is there are people whose voices are perfectly fine who wouldn't have the courage to do something as audacious as show up on a podcast where literally your ability to communicate with my listeners depends on their voice. What would you say to them?
Yeah, I would say, let me go at it this way. What I ultimately ended up concluding is that this is my voice. So I actually no longer am willing to say that I have spasmodic dysphonia. That approach implies that something unwanted from away came and took a piece of my voice. But ultimately, it ended up giving me much more value and ability to grow that took away. And one day, a few years ago, I just started looking at it differently. And I said, you know, this is not a broken voice. It's just my voice. And every single person on earth ultimately has a unique, never to be repeated voice that we're all here on earth just trying to know and love and connect with and own that essence of who we are. And my, the sound of my voice might be more pronounced in a unique way than others, but it's really just exemplary of the human experience. Voices are unique by design. And when I started viewing the world that way, it made everything so much simpler. I immediately got beyond listening to people from the perspective of evaluating whether I thought they were right or wrong. And that's one of the actual core lessons I explore in my book, is the idea that listening should be for understanding, not judgment. And the minute you make that paradigm shift, the landscape of interacting with others changes. So what I would say to anyone who had a voice limitation, literally like I do, or just had anxiety about owning their own views and perspectives, is that your voice is supposed to be unique. It's not supposed to be like anyone else's. And exactly how it sounds and exactly how you see it is just right for you. And bring it forth and share it and own it and love it.
I love that. So let's get into the seventh power. One of the things you say at the very beginning of the book is that organizations are most effective when the opportunity and responsibility for leading is shared broadly and embraced by all. Power, it turns out, is meant to be dispersed. And you talk about this distinction between power being dispersed and collected. And that is such an anomaly, I think, for the way that many of us perceive large corporations or companies. We don't see power as dispersed or as collect, you know, as dispersed. We see it as collected. I can tell you from my own experience, I never felt like I had any power when I was in the corporate world. It's why I chose not to ever go back. So how, as a society, do we move to this idea of power being dispersed? Because this isn't just a corporate problem. This is also a government problem. Like, you know, I mean, I watch the news every day and I don't feel that I have a government that acts in the interest of the citizens. I don't feel like the citizens don't have any power to shape what actually happens.
You're on to such an important topic. I believe what you just talked about is the single most important question of the 21st century for humanity. Not to put too much on the subject, but I really do. And I've thought a lot about it, and I wrote a lot about it in my book. And how I feel is this. I believe that for centuries, humans have been indoctrinated into the art of following, that we've lived in an empire-centric society where the church, the state, corporation was the entity that we all were trained to serve and put before ourselves. And we were taught to look elsewhere for leadership and power and direction. And this is really right at the essence of what inspires me. In this way, we as individuals have lost our voice or ceded a piece of our own power in a way that's neither necessary or productive. But I go on to talk about in the book, and I believe that this is a transformation that's upon us. There's a reason today that engagement at work is so low. It hovers around 33%. Or confidence in government is so low. And that reason is just what you're discussing, that in the Aquarian age, individuals around the globe are awakening to their own sacred power as an individual human being, but our organizations have been slow to adjust, which is really the essence of the transformation I'm advocating for. The old model was the employees existed to serve the company. The new model is the company exists to serve the employees. And while this will, in fact, improve the performance of the company, that becomes, as we mentioned, an outcome. And it all comes back, finally, to how the leaders think about their roles of leadership. This is really about breaking down bureaucracy, breaking down power to the center, and really becoming about distributing and dispersing that power and helping everybody see themselves as a leader and feeling safe to take the risks that are required for everyone to lead. Followership's got one big advantage, which is when things go wrong, it's never your fault because you were following. And so when leadership changes, or leadership to change, I guess I would say, followership has got to change as well. So that's why this topic, to your point, is actually a topic for everybody. Every single human on Earth, I believe, needs to contemplate, be conscious about their own power, their own ability to lead, their own ability to make choices, and the ways in which we've been indoctrinated into followership. So we've got to be really thoughtful about how we break that down. And the first step, I think, is just becoming aware of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's funny you say that, because in one way, I think that the current structure of society, you know, rewards power and incentivizes people to keep this current power structure in place. And I was thinking about this in context of this documentary my roommates and I were watching last night. It's called Where to Invade Next by Michael Moore. You know, regardless of what you think of Michael Moore, like, what was interesting is he goes around to different countries and he looks at various social policies, everything ranging from education to prison reform to healthcare. But the one that struck me in particular as somebody who has a lot of student loan debt was, you know, how he looked at education. And he went to different countries and he said that, you know, he showed basically what happened in Slovenia, where they had university is always free. He said the moment that government got involved and tried to put in a tuition hike or even think about charging, students there took to the streets, and that was it. Like, there was no tuition hike. And he said in the United States, every time there's a tuition hike, here's what happens. And he showed a clip of students basically sitting on an idyllic campus. Yet people, if literally every college student took to the streets and said, you know what, we're not coming until you guys basically make this free, then it would actually happen. Why hasn't it? Like, what is it about people here that doesn't cause them to take to the streets, even though they are absolutely livid about this situation?
Right. That is a great example. And this topic is so important about people realizing that you hold power, the most important person who will determine the future of your life is you. And it really requires, so to your question of why it hasn't happened, I think it's been because we have been indoctrinated into the view of looking externally for solutions. And I think that the transformation comes when we start to look inward. It's that iconic thought from Gandhi about becoming the change we wish to see in the world. And to your point about protest, not participating in actions that we don't believe in or that don't serve us. The other component of this, I think, at its essence, is hidden, and to me is this: it's understanding our connectivity to nature. So I have a little segment in my book where I just have been doing some learning and some work on the Navajo reservation in northern Arizona. And that night I was walking alone in the desert at sunset when five transformational words hit me. And they simply were this: in nature, power is dispersed. And I stopped in my tracks and looked around and actually then began posing a series of questions out loud by myself to the desert. I said, where's the capital of this desert? Where's its headquarters? Where's the CEO? Where are the managers? Where are the supervisors? Where's the corporate governance center? And the answer to every question was self-evident, of course. The power of nature is dispersed. It lives in every part and piece of the landscape. And here's the key point. Humans, this is what we've forgotten, I believe, or are not focused on enough. Humans are a part of nature, not above it. And as such, ultimately aspire to organize in the same way, that to the extent we would say that nature is sacred, that there's a sacred energy to the universe, we are manifestations of that. That energy lives within us, and it's learning to tap back in to the power of the individual human spirit that really inspires me. And that's the essence of what the seventh power, which is a Sioux or Lakota phrase, represents.
So, you know, it's funny, I remember very distinctly the parts on nature in the book because they really struck me. And, you know, I've been writing a lot lately about this idea of interdependency and how nature is this very interdependent system in which no aspect of nature optimizes for self-interest. So, for example, you need, you know, the clouds to give us rain so that the plants get water so that we basically get oxygen. Now, if the sun decided, you know what, I'm just going to focus on myself, to hell with the clouds and to hell with, you know, the atmosphere, that would cause lots of problems. And yet human beings tend to optimize for self-interest. And part of that is good because obviously if we didn't have some level of self-interest, we wouldn't accomplish things. There wouldn't be drive. We wouldn't make progress. But I think that we've taken it so far that we've ended up in a situation where people are able to make decisions in which they don't have to deal with the consequences of their actions. Nassim Taleb writes about this in Skin in the Game, and he calls it the Robert Rubin problem, which is actually a really good way of looking at it. Like, if you think about it, you know, people who work at the Treasury Department make economic policy that has no impact on their lives whatsoever. You know, so for example, when somebody like Steve Mnuchin says, you know what, I'm going to hand out $1,200 to every American and this is going to solve their problems, it's like, well, yeah, dude, you have $300 million to basically sit around with. So go to hell. Like, your problem, your action, you have no skin in this game as far as I'm concerned. So you're making policy that actually has no impact on your life. And that to me is a huge problem. So how do you deal with that? I mean, based on what you've just said, because again, human beings optimize for self-interest.
Right. That's so well said. So many great things there to contemplate. On component that of what you said that I think about a lot is we really are entering an age of localism where what really needs to happen is the capitals, the center, the Steve Mnuchin example, need to start thinking about not what's the biggest role we can play, but what is the smallest role we can play that's tactical and supporting and defers as much decision-making as possible to local individuals, local communities? And I think you see this when you think about humanity's biggest challenges. Let's take COVID-19 as an example. And if someone asked, who has to be a leader for humanity to defeat COVID-19? The answer, of course, is everybody, because that virus travels one individual at a time. And to me, it is such a hallmark of the age in which we're living, whether it's global warming or environmental stewardship or mitigation of a virus. Success requires everybody, but we're still operating in models where small groups of people in monolithic capitals, whether it's a corporate headquarters or a government one, they're overreaching. They're trying to do too much, and it's probably well-intentioned, but it can't work. You know, you think about this. Why is government so ineffective in so many ways? It's not because there aren't good people in government. Government's filled with good people. It's just because that approach doesn't work anymore. The planet is too, humanity is too agile and dynamic to centrally plan it.
Mm-hmm. So how then do you get this shift? Because I know one of the things you talked about when it came to overreaching is you said restraint is the opposite of overreaching. It's having the power but not using it. Restraint is not force. It's a new path to building consensus, alignment, and engagement. And that really struck me because of the fact that, you know, we don't actually encourage consensus, alignment, and engagement. Instead, what we encourage as a society is conformity. In fact, you know, you're basically an outcast the moment you're a nonconformist, even though it takes nonconformity for huge change to take place. So how do we wrestle with this paradox? And then how do you bring about this sort of evolution in consciousness at a greater level? Because, you know, it's one thing for you to write a book about it, and it's one thing for you and I to have a conversation about it. But unless this conversation literally reaches 100 million people, then, you know, we're still in a lot of ways stuck where we're at.
Right. I think there are three levels of transformation that are required. The first and most important is personal. We all got to stop, pause, look inward, and reevaluate some of our core assumptions, really become awake, alert, and alive. So I almost wish for a short time everyone on Earth could acquire spasmodic dysphonia, because that's what kicked this off for me. It forced me to stop, sit, listen, and think. And I began to change. And the second phase, which I spent the decade working on, is, okay, could this type of power shift actually be pulled through in an organization? And I had the opportunity here at our company to work on that. So across 14 sites and 150 people, we have implemented this power dispersal approach, and the results have been dramatic. Our engagement scores are running close to 90%, so about 9 out of 10 people will describe their experience of company as being meaningful to them, highly meaningful. And the performance of the company through that decade went through the roof. So I haven't just thought about it and written about it. I've actually spent a decade doing it. And now what I'm really hoping to do is to try to spread some of the opportunities of power dispersal and shared leadership more broadly, because I think unless we do, it's going to be very difficult for organizations to increase their effectiveness and for humanity to achieve its potential. But at the end of the day, long story short, we've all got to walk the talk first on an individual level, and then try to apply this change to the community right around us, the people you see and touch every day. And then hopefully that can start to create some critical mass of motion that can create larger scale change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So One of the other things that I wonder, you know, I think part of what intrigued me about your story, like before I got into the book, now that you and I've talked, this is like a much deeper conversation than I imagined it was going to be. But, you know, I think I grew up in this sort of family of academics and, you know, sort of knowledge workers. And it was pretty clear that we were not going to be blue collar people and have blue collar jobs. Like this just was the expectation that we would never do anything like that. But I know that, you know, people who work in your industry, you know, many of them do come from blue collar backgrounds. And I think that part of what I am always trying to do with the people that I talk to is to basically gain an understanding of, you know, life and sort of social situations that I personally don't have any experience with. What do you think that people in my position should know about people in those kinds of positions? Like, what do you think I'm missing?
I think you're probably not missing very much by virtue of your question, because I think half the battle or more is to be curious about that question or to have even contemplated it. So I love the question. And then I would say beyond that, the answer to me is that I think some in the white collar world might be blown away, surprised at how smart and talented and capable mentally, intellectually, and spiritually blue collar working people are. One of the stereotypes I've really try to go after is the fear that many people who work in a blue-collar job feel that they're really only valued for their physical labor, their physical capabilities, when really, like every other human, their true genius is their mental, spiritual, emotional, intellectual capabilities. And what I have seen time and time again is essentially every single person in this company is exceptionally capable of leading and handling complex challenges and doing so with grace and compassion, and that leadership is really something that's cut out for everyone.
Yeah. So, yeah, this makes me wonder, you know, Byron Raitt and I were talking about sort of how economic change has occurred over the last 20 years. And one of the big things that came about from sort of the amount of wealth that was created in technology that came out of Silicon Valley and innovation is pretty much a sort of disappearance of the middle class. But you're a CEO of a lumber company who has actually managed to sustain, you know, a middle class lifestyle for people. What is your view on the fact that we can't argue with the fact that there is a disappearing middle class in the United States that is largely the result of automation, technology and innovation. So good things are coming from it, but a very bad thing is coming from it too, because I know this from having talked to Andrew Yang, who's a presidential candidate, and he said, you know, you go around to the middle of the country, and, you know, particularly for those of us who live on the coast or live in places like I do, where it's, you know, tech startup founders and people who are pretty well off, we don't actually see the reality of what's happening. You're, like I said, as a CEO of a lumber company, somebody who's managed to continually provide a middle class lifestyle for multiple generations for people. How are we going to make this transition economically?
Yeah, I am certainly. Biased about that in a positive way, because I'm every day surrounded by people working at our company, or say contractors and builders who are buying from our company, who could definitely consider themselves to be middle class Americans. And so I see them everywhere, and I see their spirit alive and well, and I see them progressing, and I see them growing, and I see them creating opportunities for their children and things like that. Now, the thing I've thought a lot about, though, and I think it's important to talk about, is that journey was never easy. I think somehow, you know, we've acquired this notion that it used to be easier. And I don't know that that's true historically. If you look back to immigrants leaving the boat at Ellis Island 100 and whatever years ago, was it really easier then? I spent a lot of time in Native American communities. If you back up 100 years ago and visited America's reservations, would it really have been easier for Native people? So it is hard today, but I think that it has always been hard. And in a way that's a bit difficult, I think, to talk about in the right-loving spirit, I think a big part of the human experience is supposed to be a challenge. And those challenges come to different people in different ways. And it doesn't mitigate the social obligation to keep trying to improve opportunity and advance equality and make America a more equitable place. But I don't think that ever has been or will be easy. And I think what I'd say in particular about that is that the people that would consider themselves middle class or blue collar that I know, I don't think they're looking for it to be easy. I think there's a bit of a miscalculation about that community. I mean, I see people that are happy and that are positive and that are proud and that are making progress and that are participating, you know, just doing the best they can with their lives and doing a great job in so many ways. I see the story, I guess, is more uplifting and filled with opportunity than I do the opposite. Now, one could certainly listen to me say, right, and say, well, you know, you're a white 54-year-old CEO of a family business, so that's super easy for you to say, and I get that, but that is what I see working in the lumber industry in Maine.
Wow. Well, this has been absolutely fantastic and just thought-provoking and riveting and eye-opening. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews of the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think it's authenticity. I think it's knowing that voices are unique by design and that your voice is not supposed to be a manifestation of anything but you. I think it's getting comfortable with that I am sacred, that I am the seventh power.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners. Mm-hmm. This has been really just fantastic. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything else that you're up to?
Sure. Let me first say, though, thank you so much for having me. And I think that you are really on a mission with this show and the subject of Unmistakably Creative that can play a transformative role in helping humanity move in an optimal way. So cheers to you, and thank you for what you're doing. Then, for people that want to follow up with me, my website is www.kevindhancock.com. D is in David. And on that site, you can find both my books, including The Seventh Power, and more information about the subjects we're discussing. And then you can also reach out and contact me directly. And I always make time to follow up with people that reach out to me.
Awesome. Well, for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch. The skills that are essential for standing out and thriving, no matter how much technology evolved. We're talking about real differentiators here, like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.